The Football Pod with Paddy and Andy.
The amount of people looking for Andy Moore around Positano, it was all the rage. They're asking about what he's got to do next. When's the next episode out? The Football Pod's gone international.
Download the OTB Sports app and subscribe to the GAA podcast feed now.
OTB AM. With Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.
Bang on 7:30, it's Thursday morning. It's Jerry Gilroy and Johnny Ward with you today. If you want to get in touch, show 87918 is the WhatsApp number. Or, of course, you can always get us on the YouTube stream. I don't know if you watch this on YouTube or not, but that's a very easy way to get involved in the conversation. We'd love to hear from you. You can always tweet us if you're happening to watch us on Twitter, or indeed if you're listening to us on the OTB Sports app. You can tweet us at OffTheBallAM is the Twitter handle. Johnny, good morning to you. How are you?
Good morning, Jer.
Yourself and Dan McDonald causing trouble and getting yourselves in the back pages of the papers this morning.
It's great to be on the back page rather than the front, obviously. But yeah, so abusive RTE staff at LOI grounds crosses the line from Declan McBennett. This is an interview that Declan gave with the LOI Central podcast yesterday. And yeah, now to be fair, in the context of the interview, I think we spoke for maybe an hour and 10 minutes and he brought it up at the end and he didn't like bring it up as if this were a major talking point, but Dan has obviously gone with it as his major talking point from the piece.
Okay, so what is it? Tell us what's going on.
So, you know, I suppose in the years that I've been following the League of Ireland, RTE's coverage has always been a bit of an issue, whether rightly or wrongly. And I think sometimes League of Ireland fans have unrealistic ambitions in terms of media coverage. I think in general, the media coverage, especially in newspapers, isn't bad. But this year, with the League of Ireland teams doing so well in Europe, particularly Bohemians, one game was shown by RTE out of 20. And that was that really irked League of Ireland fans, particularly.
What is it like? What is it that irks them about showing one game out of 20?
Well, like RTE would argue that it's going to show the champions Shamrock Rovers. Now, it had issues with showing the Shamrock Rovers games in the Champions League because of the Olympics, and there was some other issue as well, which I actually forget now. But Bohemians went on this amazing run. And the game was on in the Aviva Stadium. I think that's the important point. And Declan McBennett brought up a lot of stats in terms of the viewing figures for League of Ireland games. But when AC Milan played Shamrock Rovers, there was, I can't exactly remember, but there was in the region of 220,000 to 250,000 people watching that game. A League of Ireland game could be like an eighth of that or even a tenth of that maybe at times if it's particularly low. So he made the point that people do want to watch games in Europe, but I asked him what can the League of Ireland do to improve, and his first point was facilities, and my point was, well, then why not show Bose in the Viva Stadium because it looks great. And there was an issue with Bose over Bose apparently offering the game to RTE for free, and he brought that up and said that wasn't really the case, but I think that incurred a lot of anger in the League of Ireland, and this then kind of resulted in, as he pointed out, or he alleges, and I've no reason not to believe him, that some RTE staff were actually abused at League of Ireland grounds.
Okay. Is there a quote about that?
Yeah, so he said, RTE is not immune from criticism. I'm not immune from criticism. There's an argument if there should be criticism, and that's rightly so, but there's also a line with regard to that criticism. That line has been overstepped this season with regard to some of the chanting and some of the behaviour with regard to RTE personnel on site and people who are engaged by RTE who are not necessarily RTE staff. There are a number of examples over the last couple of weeks where some of those who have been operating for RTE, not necessarily RTE staff or working with RTE, have felt uncomfortable at best with regard to some of the behaviour that is emanating out of the stands. That's a very serious point. He did make the point that there was like a freelancer, I think, who was got the brunt of it as well. I'm not going into the specifics, but there are two recent games. Sections of fans have their chance, and that's fine. It stays a chanting. If it stays a chanting and stays against a corporate entity, then that's one thing. When it starts to target individuals, or when it starts to make people feel uncomfortable when they're doing their professional duty and covering the league that everyone argues should be covered, needs to be covered, and deserves to be covered, that crosses the line. I'm not holding clubs responsible for their fans. That was in response to a question. And I said, well, did you report this to the clubs? Made the point, obviously, about the Hungarian FA of late and so forth. The clubs have been contacted and the FAI have been contacted. We're not dealing with snowflakes here. Probably not the best terminology. There are people who go about their daily work and understand the nature of the atmosphere when it takes into them, but there are lines that cannot be crossed.
I hadn't heard that individuals were being targeted. What he says, the corporate entity. What is being chanted?
I think his line was that RTE had replaced the FAI in the FUCK or whatever, RT. So there were a chance. I mean, I don't think we can get too high and mighty about chance at a football game. In general, League of Ireland games aren't that bad for that stuff. But there was a lot of animosity towards RT this year because it was basically ignoring the great European stuff.
And is there a view amongst the League of Ireland fans that other sports are getting preferential treatment?
Oh, totally, yeah. Obviously, you know, he would be seen as coming from a Gaelic Games background in Monaghan. Now, I kind of think that's not really relevant, and he made the point that Ryle Nugent before him was seen as a rugger bugger or whatever, and he's seen as a gah head, so to speak. And I did point out that I don't think he's much loved for the League of Ireland, but he said that's not relevant. He said, I'm basically here to show the best of Irish sport and so on and so forth. But, you know, League of Ireland fans would point out, I think 15 games in the season, including 3 in the Cup, and they would show, RT would show like 6 games early on in the season. So effectively, if they showed the first 6 games, that leaves 6 games over the following 30. So like, you just miss a massive section of the season. So I think they could cover it better, but RT is losing an awful lot of money, and he argues that they don't have the money.
Yeah, they've obviously got the money to invest in Champions League rights, and they've got the money to invest in rugby, and obviously they show the underage rugby national team a significant portion, and we were always told that those rights were bundled with the senior national side, and then they lost the senior national side and they continued to show the underage stuff. So I guess that's where the League of Ireland fans' questions are coming from. It's always felt that, do you remember, obviously you do remember Delaney talking about the League of Ireland being the problem child.
It's the difficult child.
The difficult child. Yeah. It's always felt a little bit like RT feel the same.
I feel that.
The League of Ireland.
I feel that. As I pointed out to him, I write match reports for RT's website, so, and I'm very happy to get that work, and I think RT Online does a very good job. But
go on.
But in terms of in terms of their football coverage, the thing that always perplexes me about RT, and I studied journalism in college, and we probably spoke about this a lot, it's a mixed model. So it's not, to me, it's kind of neither one nor the other. And if you listen to the interview with Declan McBennett, he almost at one point will say, well, the viewing figures aren't what it's about, or, you know, we're not beholden to the viewing figures. But then he'll talk about the viewing figures. So he'd basically say, well, if League of Ireland games were getting 100,000 plus, we'd be showing more. But the recent game, Sligo and Pats, was something like 30,000 or that. And in fairness, I will make the point that if you show a map of Ireland by a county-by-county basis, there's a massive part of Leinster going into Tipperary, into Munster, where there are no League of Ireland clubs. Like, so there isn't necessarily a national interest when there's a League of Ireland game on. I think there's a national interest. Remember Dundalk in 2016 when some of the pubs were shown Dundalk over Manchester United in the Europa League? I think there is an interest when Irish clubs play in Europe, but there isn't really an interest, and facilities are quite bad at times. So that's something the League of Ireland needs to look at. But I do think, and in fairness to him, I will say one thing. He did say the product is good. Like, he wasn't knocking the actual product on the pitch. And I think in terms of the clubs, what they're doing, and managers and players, they can take satisfaction in the fact that the head of RTE, who probably previous heads of RTE thought it was crap, does not think it's crap. He actually thinks it's a good product, but he thinks they need to improve the standards of the grounds.
It's all well and good saying that, though, Johnny, isn't it? Because you've got to back that up with the investment in it. Like, that bit where it's not their job to fix the league is fair enough, but actually there needs to be some kind of sense of responsibility to the domestic national football product, as opposed to it being an add-on or an adjunct to the rights for the national team. Because,
yeah,
like, anybody who knows anything about football has come to the conclusion that without a strong league, football in Ireland is screwed for the next 20, 30, 40 years. Until we actually establish a professional league, which is run professionally. Like, a lot of this is chicken and egg. It won't build an audience if it's never on. And if it's never on at the same time, it won't build an audience, and it won't increase the ability of the teams to generate sponsorship because they're never on TV, and that means they won't have any funding to improve their stadiums, and so it will look crap the 3-4 times a year that it's on. And so, you know, instead of actually kind of saying, it's not about the viewership now. Look, I haven't heard the whole hour-long interview. It's not about the viewership, but it kind of is about the viewership. What's our role as a national broadcaster? What's our role as taxpayers in helping this? Because bear in mind, the taxpayer is footing the bill for the Champions League rights, which is going to pay Ronaldo's wages. That's how that whole thing works. Mm-hmm. Like all the national broadcasters, all the broadcasters who pay for it. And we're the ones who are footing the bill for the GAA rights, and we're the ones who are footing the bill for the rugby rights as well. And now the taxpayers involved in this experiment around the streaming service for the
rugby.
For the rugby championship, which it's an interesting model, and we'll see if it works. I wonder what the risk that we as taxpayers are taking on. I wonder what our guarantees are. It'd be very interesting to see what the finances and how that actually all pans out. So, and I'm sure that takes up a lot of time and energy and effort for the organisation. You know, again, that's helping to grow South African rugby, and maybe that's exactly the right thing for the national broadcaster and for the taxpayer to be getting involved in. But it seems like there's just a gap in the responsibility here. Like, either they are responsible or they're not. And if they're not, fair enough. But this kind of half in, half out isn't working for anybody.
Yeah, and I think that goes back to the fact RT is a mixed model. It's like it doesn't
explain
like
what you mean by mixed model.
Well, it's not a BBC in that the BBC doesn't have ads, obviously, on its channels. Like, so RT has ads. It also has like really annoying ads at times on the RT player. So it's a public service broadcaster at one level. So it gets funding that obviously the likes of Virgin doesn't get, but at the same time it's beholden to advertisers, so it doesn't effectively show much League of Ireland because not enough people watch it, and it's as simple as that, really. But I made the point as well that if they show 15 League of Ireland games in the season, there's no magazine show at all around soccer on RT. Nothing. There's no highlight show anymore. They ditched Soccer Republic, which was literally allowed, in my view, to run into the ground. There's no show around, like, even English football, Champions League. There's nothing on RT now apart from live soccer. Nothing else, whereas you have Against the Head, the Sunday game, so on and so forth. And I just think that's odd. But he made the point that nobody watches anymore, and he said highlight shows are basically dead apart from the Sunday game and Match of the Day. Said nobody cares on a Monday anymore. He said they don't care within an hour of the game because they've already seen it. And obviously there's a bigger point there about streaming and people watching things on their phones and people, you know, Netflix winning all the awards now rather than traditional media and all that. But I don't know. I still think there are a lot of stories within Irish football that just aren't told by RT.
Did you come away from this enthusiastic and hopeful about what the future of the League of Ireland on the national broadcaster might look like?
No. No, not at all. I mean, Declan was at a stretch to say like the coverage would be as good next year, and wasn't entirely ruling out that it'd be less. So no, I wasn't. But I don't know. We as a league have to. Stephen Bradley spoke about doing things ourselves, and I will say one thing about Declan McBennett. I was desperately disappointed in the take up of LOI TV. I think League of Ireland fans let themselves down there during the pandemic when effectively they were offered like every game for I think it was of 60 quid or something, and the take up was poor. And I think when they weren't spending any money on the football club, they could have been a lot better than that. It was pittance, and a lot of people didn't subscribe. So I mean, that's their choice, but that definitely didn't endear the League of Ireland to RTE.
All right, give us your views. Morning. 0879 180 180 is the WhatsApp number if you want to get in touch with us. OTB AM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. We should talk about Aaron Connolly, who scored twice last night.
We've got a goal scorer
for Brighton.
Our problems are solved.
One of the papers said he had scored one goal in the calendar year,
which isn't great when it's in late September.
Yeah, but you know, like every road has a turn.
Yeah, it's Father on Bohr, not Will Cossa on. Wonder does Aaron speak the Gaeilge? Liam Scales, I think, speaks a bit of Irish. First Celtic player maybe to speak a bit of Irish. But it was a real Aaron Connolly goal, the one I saw anyway. It was like edge of the box, kind of reminded me of that goal against Spurs that suggested we had like the best striker ever. But I think with Aaron, there's a wider point in terms of there's always been a suspicion that he's a little bit different. Whether it's his social media stuff, his excess confidence and all that, but I think he's had a bad year in terms of his confidence, and he's only human as well. I think it has affected him. I felt as much as you know, the point was made that he wasn't fit entirely for the Ireland games. I thought it was mental fitness with him. I thought he made the wrong choice so many times, and it wasn't like that he wasn't able to make the runs, because his runs were causing massive problems for Pepe in Portugal.
It was sharpness
and mental sharpness. I think he may have had a couple of issues off the pitch this year,
but he definitely has had maturity issues. He's been on the front pages of the papers, which you don't want to be when you're not in the first team.
You don't. And Kenny really backed him and then obviously ditched him at half time in the Azerbaijan game. And I think that was a sign maybe that Kenny, and you know, Kenny I think has trying to manage Conley and all that, and maybe he's been playing when others could have played ahead of him, but his response for Ireland will be interesting, because you know, you can't forget what he has achieved already in, when he plays well, and he does have pace, which we badly need, and you can knock the Carabao Cup, but I wouldn't knock it at all. He was playing Swansea, who'd be decent standard. Interesting to note that Ryan Manning came off on I think at half time for Swansea, and goals give you confidence at whatever level, I think, but it'll be hard for him to get back into the side though.
Into the Brighton side, it will be. But at the same time, if so, he's obviously going to continue playing in the Carabao Cup.
Got to score goals, like,
and that's the thing. Mm. They're like Brighton are doing well at the moment. All the XG conversations that we've had about Brighton over the last 18 months, they're finally starting to score those goals, and it will be difficult to get back in the team while that happens. But he will be coming into a team that is doing well and creating chances, and so therefore, you know, it's right that we'd be hopeful, and it's right that we. I think. Certainly, most of the WhatsApp groups that I'm in were aflame with criticism of Conley around the Ireland games, because
which is interesting, because he was such a threat in Faro, but he just made the wrong choice so many times and he screwed up so many times that it was like, well, you're causing major problems here, but then you're causing problems for us by not converting these chances.
Yeah, the first goal last night was actually deflected, right?
Mm.
It may well be that, but that's exactly what he needed.
Scrappy goal.
He needed something to go his way, but the second goal apparently is the same as the first goal. It doesn't take a deflection and you're like, okay, that's it.
Mm.
That's all you need. You just need a little bit of something to go your way and remind yourself that actually you've made it to the Premier League, because you know, very few people in the entire global situation who play football make it to the Premier League, and he's there. He just needs to knuckle down.
He also has his this to the crowd, which would be that'd be Aaron as well. So seemingly he was getting a bit of grief from the Swansea fans. Hopefully they weren't chanting about RTE. to be fair,
so look, we're hopeful. Essentially,
I think Ida played against Liverpool the other night, but I'm not sure. I didn't watch that game. I obviously didn't score, but Creevan Keller saved a penalty. Liverpool's second choice goalie can't get a look in with Ireland. Things could be worse.
Yeah, okay. All right, if anybody does want to get in touch with us, let's go. 087-9180-180 is the WhatsApp number, and I'll tell you what's coming up between now and 10 o'clock on OTBAM this morning. Daniel Harris is standing by. We're going to talk about Manchester United and the start of the season so far. Sports pages at 10 past 8. We'll bring you a clip from the latest episode of episode 20 of the Football Pod with Paddy and Andy talking to Tommy Rooney about high performance. John Duggan's going to join us at 8:40 for a quick run through of today's stories. After that, we've got Tony McEntee. We're going to get his view on what the future championship should look like. He's been renewed as the Sligo boss. Louise Quinn is going to talk to us about scoring the winner for the Republic of Ireland against Australia. And then Matt Williams is going to give us his thoughts on the return of rugby proper this weekend at 9:30. OTBM is brought to you by Gillette. Good mornings. Start with Gillette, put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Daniel Harris is with us. Daniel, good morning to you. How are you?
Hi, I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, so does the Carabao Cup matter? Does defeat in the Carabao Cup matter for Manchester United?
Yeah. Every game matters. So I'm sure that the players will be disappointed to have lost. As a supporter, I'm annoyed that they've lost. And particularly when you haven't won a trophy in a few years, you want every opportunity. But it's also a little bit more than that, because by going out in the first round, you then lose a number of games, minutes for certain players. So now you've got Anthony Elanga, Jesse Lingard. When are they going to play? And you need them to play because you need them to be ready, because you want them to play. And you also need the younger players to develop. But that's now not going to happen. So obviously losing in that game is not the end of the world, but it's also not helpful.
Why did they lose in that game? Is that second team not good enough to win games against West Ham at the moment? Or
against West Ham's second team? No, they're more than good enough. They should be beating West Ham's second team. But that's how football is sometimes, in that West Ham started well and it was enough. They hung on really well. They defended the box well, and United didn't really create enough chances. They had the one that kept right after Mason Greenwood came on, and he made a massive difference. He was the best player on the pitch by miles. But they didn't have quite enough, because the way that football is, goals are rare, and it's possible to defend deep and to restrict space. And when a decent, well-drilled team does that, scoring against them is difficult, and United found it difficult. I mean, again, obviously, they should have had a penalty. Can't really gloss over that. It was an obvious penalty. The referee was looking right at it. So strange to think that he didn't give it. But as always, that's not the way the reason United lost. United had plenty of time to redeem John Moss's mistake. They didn't. They couldn't. And yeah, they just didn't have quite enough class in the final third. And I mean, I'm sure Anthony Martial is getting a load of stick on Twitter because he looked indolent. He looked slow. He looked like he didn't want to score goals. And that is one of the problems when you have a big squad, is that there'll be certain players whose seniority demands inclusion, means that they demand inclusion in games like this. So Martial's one of those players. And you just saw when Anthony Elanga came on, and he was playing a left back, but he's electric. And he's everything in that aspect that Martial is not. And similarly, what is the point in playing Juan Mata? The guy's basically retired, and I mean this in the nicest possible way. I mean, he's a lovely boy, hugs and all of that, but he's not the future, and he's not good enough in the present for him to be worth getting a start ahead of other players who might play well for United in the future, who could do with a game like this. I understand why Ole played him. I mean, he obviously likes him. They seem to want him to be part of the coaching staff. In order to do that, they've probably got to give him some kind of football, but this is elite level football. It's not, he's a nice boy, we like him, let's give him a start. And the team's going nowhere with Mata. He seems to me to be a waste of a spot on the bench when he's on the bench every game. I mean, in what circumstances, really, are they ever going to bring him on? So giving him a start last night, when you could give that start to someone like Hannibal Medjugorje, who looks a lot like someone who's going to be a United player, seems a lot more sensible to me than just handing Mata another appearance. Yeah, I mean, I'm not supposed to say I don't get it. I do get it, but it doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
That's going to be a challenge, Daniel, isn't it, for Solskjaer? Because, like, the whole Ronaldo thing, and he's had such a great start, but it's such a bloated squad now. And, you know, even if you are, and I don't suspect Martial is entirely the most professional kind of character in the world, but some players are effectively, whether they like it or not, they will down tools. They had 27 shots and 6 on target, which is incredible. I mean, just looking at the stats, it was a game in which Ronaldo would have tried, but Martial is probably one of these players that's now just going nowhere.
Yeah, I mean, there was one particular occasion, I think it was Greenwood who got to the byline, and Martial just didn't run to the near post. He didn't make any kind of movement that you would expect from a goal scorer. I mean, Fergie always used to sell his strikers, you get your goals at the front post, I guess, because of all the things that can happen between the front post and the back post when you put the ball across. But he never really did make those runs. Didn't make those runs. He looks to have lost his gas as well. And he's had quite a lot of injuries. And I understand, like, it is difficult to leave him out, because if you don't, then why have you got him? But yeah, he's someone I would definitely have taken an offer for in the summer. Probably needs a move now for his career. And as you say, Ronaldo coming has made it very difficult for Martial, and also very difficult for Cavani if he ever gets fit, because in what circumstances are you picking one ahead of the other, given that Ronaldo is always fit and always fresh? So yeah, the squad is quite bloated, and I would like to see more reliance on the younger players now at this point. And I mean, I don't mean that to sound ludicrous in a way that all supporters want to see their club's young players playing, and we always think that they're better than the older players. But it feels now that United are good enough to wear using a younger player, because there are so many other good players around them. But what the point you make about the shots is, they did have a lot of shots last night, and not a lot of them were on target. I don't think that is exactly a facility of the shooting, but a facility of the opportunities that were created, that there weren't that many chances made for a player to have a shot that looked likely to go on target. And that is partly because that sometimes happens, and it's partly because United still haven't totally worked that out, and also because West Ham, as I said at the top, West Ham defended really well.
The Moyes story, I don't know what you've made of it, but there's a lot of satisfaction in watching a guy like that, who's, I guess, had almost been written off, and what he's doing there, to go back to Old Trafford. I know it's Carabao Cup, but to win with your second team, effectively, with a shade of comfort by the sounds of it, I imagine there's massive satisfaction there.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't call it a comfortable win, but yeah, I think that's right. Moyes is doing a brilliant job. And what really the case is that hardly any manager succeeds in every job, and every job is different, so it demands different skills. So we shouldn't be surprised to see managers fail in one place and then succeed in another. And what Moyes is really good at is, he's good at organising a team. He's also good at finding not elite, but high-class talent. He did it really well at Everton. He found, I don't know, Stephen Pienaar seems like a good example. Fellaini, players who no one had heard of, who Moyes found, who were really good for sort of places 5 to 9 in the Premier League. And he was really good at that, and he gets players to play for him. Managing Manchester United wasn't for him because I think that he's not imaginative enough. His bar of what constitutes elite level talent was too low, and the way that he went about inspiring the squad wasn't suitable for the kind of squad that he had, who was a squad who just won the league by miles. But he is exactly the right kind of manager for the kind of squad that West Ham have. You can see that the players really love playing for him, and they're producing for him.
Can I ask you about Van de Beek last night? How did he play?
He played okay. And that is one of the things with Van de Beek. He is often, or I say often, we don't actually see him play that often, but a lot of the time he plays, he is okay. I think maybe okay is harsh. Perhaps he was one of the better players, but it's really hard to judge him when you see him play a game, then do nothing for 2 or 3 months, then a game. It's not really fair. You could suggest that perhaps he's not doing enough in training, but even at this point, it's really hard to see a route for him because of the position that he plays. Because
where does he play? Is there a possibility he could play as a holding midfielder? Is that not ever going to be in his future? Essentially,
no. Maybe he could. Maybe he could play as a holding midfield player with McTominay and Bruno in a midfield three. Maybe that could happen. But then, what do you do with Pogba? What I'm always looking for this United team to do is I want to find a way of playing Pogba and Bruno and not playing Pogba on the left wing. Mm. As far as I can see, the only way you can do that is if you play McTominay in midfield. Like, Fred is neither good enough nor physical enough. Matic isn't quick enough. But McTominay's performance against West Ham, although Pogba played on the left, was starting to... If you look at... There's a video knocking about on Twitter of McTominay's passing in that game, his players, the cleverness and the speed of his passing into midfield, which was the thing he really needs to add to his game to be able to play in that number six role. If he can do that, then you can have Pogba and Bruno in midfield, perhaps, and Van de Beek is your rotation player. He's not going to be better than the other two, but he'd be good enough when you want to give the other two a rest, because ahead of that, you've already got Ronaldo who's going to play every game. Then you've got Greenwood, Sancho and Rashford fighting for the other two places. And it really doesn't look long like it will be long before Elanga is starting to seriously push for that place as well, those places as well. So you could play Van de Beek as your rotation player in the midfield. And there are signs that he might be able to do that. But he played all right last night without really demanding more than what he's been getting.
Okay. So he's emerging as a squad player, who, and that's fine. That's, you know, some players aren't going to make it. Is as nailed on starters. Where is Jadon Sancho in the pecking order at the moment? Because he started last night, and he started in a team that included Juan Mata and Jesse Lingard and Donny van de Beek and Nemanja Matic and Anthony Martial. He must be looking around, going, "No, this isn't my team. I'm in the wrong room. I think I should be in the other room."
Yeah, that's true. But he'll know that he needed the game because he's not played a lot. And he didn't play brilliantly last night, but I thought that he looked one of United's more threatening players. That when he gets the ball, things start to happen. That he's starting to move people around. He just looks so beautiful and natural on the ball, Sancho. Keeps it so close to his body. He looks capable of going either way. So although he wasn't good enough last night, he'll be better for that game. The thing with him is that he basically had the whole summer off, but not off, in that he was training and doing all the stuff that all the other players were doing without actually getting any of time on the pitch that would have enabled him to start the season with a running jump, effectively. So, I mean, I'd like to see him on the right because United have players for the left. Marcus Rashford isn't that far off. So, and the thing with United is that they've lacked someone on the right for a long time that enables them to stretch the play, that helps Wan-Bissaka, that kind of compensates Wan-Bissaka's lack of finesse. So the thing is Greenwood's been playing so well that he's been playing on the right recently. But before Rashford comes back, I wouldn't mind having a look at Greenwood on the left because he can still come in on his right foot. He's still got good enough right foot to do that. He's still going to look to get towards the box. Whereas if Sancho's on the right, he gives you the option of stretching the pitch, of looking like he might go on the outside. And I think that will help Wan-Bissaka and also enable United to stretch the play. So, yeah, as you say, Sancho doesn't want to be in a League Cup team. Well, he's not going to be till next season now. But it would be silly to start getting agitated about what he has or hasn't done so far, because he's coming back to fitness, he's moved to a new league, and he looks to me like someone who is an extremely talented player who's just waiting to explode. So yeah, I wouldn't be overly concerned about him.
Okay, so you're not in any way worried that the speed with which he's been incorporated into the team and the quality of the performances hasn't been at the level that it should be for the money. It's like a settling in period.
Yeah, I mean, I think with him and with United as a whole, like you can look at things positively, you can look at things negatively. You can look at United and say, well, actually, a lot of the stuff we've seen this season is the stuff everyone's been criticising and complaining about United for the last few seasons. I mean, the Southampton game wasn't good, the Wolves game. Or you can say that in the league, they've won 4 out of 5. They've got the same number of points as the teams who are top of the league. And you can see that they've got very obvious areas that will improve, because Sancho will get better. This is not whether Sancho turns out to be a £70 million player and a world beater. We don't know if that's going to happen yet. But I think we can say with total certainty that he is better than what we've seen so far. This is not the player that we're going to see from Sancho. He's not going to just stay like this. Like, I don't think anyone would say that. Varane's still improving. Rashford's still to come back. The players are getting used to playing with Sancho. They're getting used to playing with Ronaldo. But McTominay's coming back on his way back from fitness as well. So there are a lot of reasons to think that United are going to improve. There are a lot of reasons to think that the improvement will not be by enough to win the two big pots. So that would then put a lot on the FA Cup, because they can really do with winning something this season. And I can see both sides of that. I can see the same old complaints and the same old mistakes. But I can also see, yeah, that they are improving, and they are, as I said, joint top on points with the teams who are top of the league.
If you contrast it to Liverpool, though, Daniel, it's just like it couldn't be more stark, in the sense of, you know, Klopp has a very, very select number of players that he plays in, especially in attacking areas. And obviously he mentioned like that he was surprised that there wasn't a proper offer for Origi, but Origi's hardly had a look in. And obviously Jota's either there with Firmino as sort of the fourth player. But surely it's going to become a serious, serious issue that he's so many players that he has to keep happy. And I know his kind of management of the dressing room has been hailed, but like this is surely a ticking time bomb, because people just get pissed off if they're not even third in the pecking order, and they're like, how am I going to get a game here? And then that festers a bit of like annoyance, I suppose, among other players and so on and so forth. This is surely going to become an issue.
Well, if anyone can persuade someone of the value of substitutes, then Ole is that guy. I was actually thinking about that with regard to Lingard last night, because I thought he should have left for his own career. And I thought that United should have encouraged him to leave, partly to get the money, but also partly for his own career. But I guess what's probably happened is Ole has said to him that he'll get enough time on the pitch. As with Ole, you don't know when that time's going to be, because some of the time on the pitch will depend on who's available when. But ultimately, being a substitute is a specialist role, and you're a massive part of the team. So I don't think that... I think Martial's got a problem. Martial's going to have to leave. I don't think that he is going to get very many opportunities unless United are desperate. I don't think that Matt is going to get many opportunities unless United are desperate. But the others, so you've got Ronaldo, Rashford, Greenwood and Sancho. Like, those are your first four. Then Cavani's not even fit yet. So he's played about half an hour this season. So he's not even part of that conversation, because he's not been ready to play. I wouldn't be totally surprised if Cavani left in January, because one of the things that I found so weird about United signing Ronaldo and the media discourse about he's going to ruin it for the young players and this is a ridiculous signing and what's he going to do, is that at the very basic, most simplistic simpletons level, is he better than Cavani? The answer to which is yes, by many factors. By many orders of magnitude. And that's not to say that Cavani is not an excellent player. He is. But Ronaldo is a lot better than him. So United just went and improved that position for almost no money whatsoever, or just negligible amounts of money, really. So that was at the very most basic level why the Ronaldo deal made sense. It was a massive upgrade on what they had in that position before. Now, when does Cavani actually get to play? I don't really know. Perhaps he'll get the home games against Norwich, I don't know, those kinds of games. But for that to even be a question, he's got to be fit. And he's not even fit that often. So if he's only fit for 50-60% of the games, then yeah, he's only going to play 15% of those games. Yeah, he might decide in January he wants to leave. And if he does, then he does. Or he might decide that being a substitute in a team that is challenging for big pots is actually a role of responsibility and a role of value in the way that Solskjaer decided that was the case for his team. Now, if you're not challenging for titles, then I guess much harder to keep those kind of players happy. Like, as soon as United started, as soon as Fergie left and United were crap, players like Hernandez decided to leave. Well, I mean, I'm sure Van Gaal also kind of forced him out, but it's very hard to keep players happy if they're not playing and you're not challenging for titles and they're not ending the season with a medal around their neck having contributed. But for as long as United are in that mix, they're in that mix for the league title, and I mean, there's only five games gone, but they're there right now, then I think players want to be a part of that. And it's a question of whether the players who literally are never playing, really, like Martial and Mata, who are the ones who probably want to leave.
We had Paul McGrath on yesterday, and Kenny Cunningham asked him about, obviously he's a Manchester United fan, and he was like, oh look, I don't want anything bad to happen to Solskjaer, but Kenny asked him specifically about Antonio Conte being out there, and he kind of purred a little bit and was like, I would like to see what would happen if Antonio Conte was in charge of this group of players. As a Manchester United fan, is there a part of you that is like, I wouldn't mind seeing an alternative world where I understand the value of having a club legend, Solskjaer, and I can see the work that he's done in making sure that the squad understands what it means to be Manchester United players, and the value of that is completely understated in football, and I think underappreciated, particularly from fans who are outside the club and from journalists and all that kind of stuff. Is there any part of you that would like to run an alternative reality where actually it is Antonio Conte, it is somebody who is a league winner and who has competed for the big pots in a meaningful way?
No, not Conte. Letting Conte loose with this squad, I don't know, I'm trying to think of an analogy here. It's like giving someone the paints, it's like giving the paints and the canvas for the Mona Lisa and giving it to Animal from The Muppets, who is great in a particular context, but no, I wouldn't want to see Conte with these players. Conte's done some brilliant things. I mean, like when he won the league with Chelsea, the quantity of that was on him was very significant, and I massively respect that. But I don't want to watch Conte football, and I don't want Conte anywhere near the kind of squad that Ole has built. Like, I'd want someone who understands what good football is. I want someone who's going to play young players. And I wouldn't want someone who would, much as I loved, I mean, it sounds ridiculous, I want United to win the league, but Conte kind of turns up, won the league and left the mess to someone else to clear up. And much as I want United to win the league, I feel like I've kind of seen enough of that. One of the reasons United have been so dreadful since Fergie left is that they just keep bringing in different managers with different ideas about how the game should be played, from Moyes to Van Gaal to Mourinho. And that's why you end up, every time a manager comes in, the first thing they have to do is start a monumental cleanup job, because they have nothing, they don't want the other guy's players, and you understand why they don't want them. And so, no, I wouldn't want Conte to come in, start selling players that I think are good, start buying players that I think are crap, and then leave in 2 years and you've got the same thing again. I think what United have done now is they're implementing an overarching structure in the club, whatever, where they're saying United want to play in a particular way. To play in a particular way is going to require particular players. To be able to do that is going to require developing your own players. Now, I'm not saying necessarily, in fact, I'm not saying at all, that Solskjaer is the best manager out there for United. I'm not particularly sure who I would now go and get. Looking at the world of football, who would I go and get and think that person would do the best job? And when you look at the job that Ole has done, there is a strong chance, and I totally feel this, that he might not have that extra bit of gas to take them from where they are to where they were. But from him to take them from where they were to where they are now in the time that he's done it is a not insignificant effort, because what he's done is he's rebuilt the first team, he's rebuilt the scouting system, he's got Darren Fletcher and John Murta who are above him, who are the kind of pillars of the structure that will remain whatever happens. And there's a way of playing, or a way at least that he wants to play, that now seems to be non-negotiable. So the next person that comes in will need to have the same ideas about how football should be played, and that person is not Antonio Conte.
Okay, in a way, they've gone so far with Solskjaer, they need to see how it plays out and to see if maybe he can discover that gas, or if he can add somebody to the backroom team who challenges the thought process to get them to that next level.
Yeah, he's earned this season. I mean, if this season's a mess and United finish a distant fourth or whatever, fifth, or if they finish second or third and they're still 15 points off the league title, then that is a problem. I still think he's really a couple of players short, but if they end up finishing third and they're 5 points off the title, then you've got to have a difficult conversation, because that will be a big improvement, because that means probably that they've challenged for the title, which is what you want to see.
Yeah.
And then you're still asking that same question. So then if you go and get the player that he thinks might be missing, do you give him one more year? And I don't know what the answer to that will be, because it will be based on what we haven't seen yet. But hopefully they're going to improve. I mean, I felt like Scott McTominay's performance was very encouraging against West Ham. They played quite well against West Ham. They should have won it more easily. When Sancho, as I just said before, when Sancho's playing better, they'll be better. So at the moment, again, like, I don't think anyone who thinks that they're certain that Ole is going to take United to win titles is an idiot, because there's no reason, nothing we've seen that could make us so confident that that would be the case. But I don't think that he's someone at this point I'm absolutely looking to replace, partly because I look at the world of football and I think, well, who's it going to be? Like, this time last year, you could think, well, maybe Tuchel, maybe Nagelsmann. They have jobs now. And anyone else who comes in, like, the only sure things are Guardiola and Klopp, and they're out of reach. You can't get them. And so then who would it be? And if the next guy's a punt, then it might be worth punting on the guy who has been improving this squad year on year and has taken a club that was an absolute mess and turned it around into something that looks like it's good. There's a club that players want to come to. The players are happy and they're playing some decent football, not as much decent football as you'd like. They're scoring loads of goals and you can see lots of room for improvement and where things might get better. But as I said right at the start, it's that nagging doubt. It's not even a nagging doubt. It's right there for all of us to see that at the same time, the same things we've been complaining about for a couple of years are still there.
Yeah.
And Ole's definitely running out of time to resolve them, but he has still got time to resolve them. And the fact that after every bad result, we sort of have this conversation is kind of strange, in that it doesn't get had about lots of other managers. It's not just it doesn't get had about Klopp and Guardiola. Of course it doesn't. Like, they've justified their status by winning stuff.
That's the thing. That's the bit.
They don't need to have this conversation, but if you look at where United were when Ole took over, and Gary Neville was on the telly saying it'd take 5 years to make United title challenges. He's done it a lot quicker than that. When Alex Ferguson, obviously Alex Ferguson had a track record, so it's not a good, it's not a great comparison. When he was at Aberdeen, he smashed the old firm with Aberdeen. That was an amazing achievement, maybe even his greatest achievement. But when he turned up at United, he had Norman Whiteside, he had Brian Robson, he had Paul McGrath, who you talked about, like proper great players. And it still took him quite a significant time to win something against far inferior opposition to the opposition that Ole has. And this is also something that I think people need to take notice of. The Premier League, I'm not certain that this is so of the actual best team. Like, I don't think the team that wins the league this season will be the best team in Premier League history. But never before in Premier League history, and probably in the history of English football, given that football didn't start in 1992, have we had four teams of the level of United, Chelsea, Liverpool and City
100%.
who are very close to the best teams in the world. And not just that, Gary Neville said that on Monday Night Football a few weeks ago, beginning of the season. But what I actually think the point that he missed is also really another important point is below that, your Everton's, your Tottenham Hotspurs, your Arsenal's, like all of that, your Arsenal's, all of that stuff, like those guys, those teams are much, much better. Every team has a player that can hammer you. Every team has a player that has players that can absolutely take you apart from about, like, so if we forget the top four, from about fifth to about 10th, 11th, those teams are good. And they have good players, and they are miles, miles better than those teams have ever been before. And so winning the league is difficult.
Yeah.
And it's more difficult than it ever was before. And so not winning the league, like one of Guardiola and Klopp, who we know are all-time great managers and have great squads, one of them's not going to win the league
maybe
this season.
Maybe both, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. No. And Tuchel is not going to win the league this season. So I wouldn't necessarily say that not winning the league this season means that you're not good enough. But obviously the managers that have proved that are good enough already, you don't have to have that conversation about them.
And that's why it happens. But that's why it happens with Solskjaer. And it happens because the young boys game happened and it was a repeat of some patterns from last year. And it will continue to happen until he wins the Champions League and gets that freedom that those managers have is like, ah, actually, I do have a track record now. And the point you made about Ferguson and the old firm is well made. Daniel, good stuff. Thanks a million for joining us. Cheers.
No, I'm going to see you again. Have a good day, everyone.
14 minutes past 8 this morning here. Daniel Harris giving us his thoughts on the situation. Man United out last night in the Carabao Cup, beaten 1-0 by David Moyes. I think that's his first win in any competition, is it, since against Man United?
Moyes-y. I mean, I wasn't aware of that, but Daniel speaks very well. I think trophies can be overrated as well, though. Like, finishing second in the Premier League is a hell of an achievement at the moment, and they've become a good team. Like, I didn't think Solskjaer should have gotten the job. He didn't have the track record to get the job.
No, but it was
It was an emotional decision. Now, it was probably in the context of where they'd been, as you mentioned, the three managers post Fergie, and when you have a gap after Fergie, it does take a long time. There was probably one of the worst jobs anyone could get in football, bizarrely enough, was taken over after Fergie, and look how long it has taken Moyes to rebuild. But Solskjaer has turned Manchester United into a very good football team, and as Daniel says, if they don't win the league this season, they could have a brilliant season and finish third.
Look, what they absolutely cannot afford to go out of the Champions League in the group stages.
I agree with that. And the young boys thing was a shambles with the red card and all that. They would have won the game otherwise. I think he made a massive mistake leaving Ronaldo on with 10 men, because Ronaldo in a team with 10 men, he doesn't do anything off the ball. He's not really capable anymore, and so they'd effectively 9 men when they didn't have the ball. They did massive pressure against him. He was taken off and they lost the game.
It's not like they were up against Chelsea.
It's very hard with 10 men for that long, though. And maybe a Mourinho team might have dug in, and the goal in the last minute was...
Chelsea went up down to 10 men against Liverpool, and they knew exactly what to do.
That's fair.
And that's the difference.
It should have been a draw, which wouldn't have been a disaster. They conceded 5 minutes in injury time, whatever. But yeah, I do agree, if they get knocked out of the Champions League group stages. As Daniel says, the standard of the English game at the moment is so high. It's also happened at a time when Spanish football is on a bit of a low.
The other thing is that... So one of the tweets that we've got this morning is, fair play to Solskjaer for playing all the kids last night. Young Mata and Matic will be great first team players in a few years. So Colin Mack has been in touch at Off the Ball AM. There are just parts of it where you're like, this doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, but like, they should still be beating West Ham probably with that team.
I know they didn't.
But like, if you're not playing Mata and Matic at all, and Matic is playing a little bit, you have to keep them somewhat happy.
Do you? Or because they actually, when they play, they very rarely contribute. If you compare Nemanja Matic with James Milner, and the fact that Milner can still play and sub in and out for Liverpool, it, like, that's the difference. That's the top 10% of the management, where Klopp is able to keep this squad happy and actually get performances from these players, as opposed to just giving them minutes. Maybe it's unfair, it's apples and oranges, but there aren't many of those senior Manchester United players who you think are actually contributing to the winning the league.
They probably should be gone, really, you know.
That's the thing.
Yeah, I don't agree with bloated squads. I think I think less is more, and I've always been a believer that you've a strong core of players, 14 or 15 players, and then primarily you've very young players who are hungry to come on in games like last night, not 22 players who are all senior pros, and because 11 of them won't be happy at any given time. I think he's a bloated squad. I think he does need to get rid of some of them players. I agree with you. I think you should be playing young players in games like that.
One last thing is that this kind of like, if we don't win it this year but we get close, we'll definitely, you know, we're going in the right direction. You actually can't say that anymore, because Erling Haaland is going to be in the Premier League more than likely next season.
With who?
For one of the teams. I don't know.
The champions, whoever that is.
He might decide that he wants to go to Liverpool. He might decide he wants to go to City. It's unlikely he's going to go to United unless they get rid of Ronaldo at the end of the season, and Ronaldo's a stopgap, in which case that would be amazing. Jude Bellingham could be in the... Maybe he is a player that signs for Manchester United, but maybe there's Declan Rice. I don't know. It's like, there's no guarantee that this squad is going to get closer to whoever are the champions. So essentially, you've got to do it now.
They're not far off. They're not far off, but as you
say, we'll see over the course.
We genuinely
of the
have a four-horse race with four outstanding sides, so three of them can't win the league. So, like,
I hope that it is, and it goes the whole way, that we don't see one of them drop off.
Yeah, like, I wasn't really convinced by Liverpool from last season, but they've started exceptionally well, and it's great. It really is great. I know you can be cynical about the money at the top level of football, but at the moment, really, who cares? It's just going to be thrilling entertainment. But three of them are not going to win the league, and it's probably two of them could have a very good season.
Yeah. And that right there is why sports washing works.
That is it. That's why the great triviality keeps us awake and talking about stuff that doesn't really matter.
18 minutes past 8 this morning. Keep an eye on the OTB channels this week because our road shows are back with thanks to Cadbury Ireland. This week it's a Manchester United special. We're going to hear from Yapstam, Albert Morgan, the Kitman, and Stephanie Roach. The Yapstam interview airs tonight on Off the Ball, and everything will be available in the OTB football podcast feed and on youtube.com/offtheball. So make sure you subscribe, and the hashtag is Cadbury FC. We have a very busy show to come. We're going to hear from Sligo boss Tony McEntee, Irish footballer Louise Quinn, who scored the winner against Australia a little later this morning. We'll also bring you Thursday's sports pages next. Quick break.
OTB AM.
20 minutes past 8 this Thursday morning. You're very welcome. If you've just joined us, you've missed a conversation about Manchester United and some other stuff as well. RT's coverage of the League of Ireland. If there's any of that stuff that you'd like to get involved in, then you can leave a comment in the YouTube stream, tweet us at OffTheBallAM, or of course you can get us on 0879 180 180. That's our WhatsApp number. Bring it through the sports pages. We'll start with otbsports.com. It is Gavin Bazunu, who is already a fan favourite in Portsmouth. It's a piece that the lads did last night with Jonty Coleman. John Duggan's Ryder Cup preview, we'll talk to him about that in a couple of minutes time. Paul O'Connell, carbohydrates and protein. We had Paul O'Connell in the studio recently talking about his body fat coming down, the same way Roy Keane did. Van Grant confirms that Caroline Currid is working with Munster. Caroline Currid's success rate is pretty sensational. So Tyrone, Tipperary, Limerick, David Rudisha, Paul O'Connell at one point, and now obviously Munster as well. So whatever she's doing something right. The Irish Times front page this morning, Larry, it's everything I expected and more. And they've got a story about Harrington and his tattoo. Any tattoos, Johnny?
No, never.
You never think about that.
If I were to have one, it'd be like an ohm stone or something like that on the calf, because I get a lot of dirt on my calf, so it looks like I have a tattoo there just from the chain of my bicycle. So I'd go for an ohm stone, but
to show off your calves, that essentially to draw attention to your best draw attention part of your
to
body,
to draw attention to the ohm stone.
Look at my calves.
God,
you and Jack Grealish.
I have a great pair of calves.
Yeah.
Well, they wouldn't be up with Jack Grealish now, to be fair. In any sense.
So that's
you
that.
Fan of the ohm writing?
I don't know.
Our oldest language in Ireland in terms of the written word, I think.
I mean, I know what it is. It feels a little bit like random person goes to Vegas and gets a tattoo of some Chinese writing and you're like, do you know what it
possibly
says?
Possibly whilst drunk or... Yeah.
It just feels a little bit, it's Sanskrit. I'm like, do you speak Sanskrit?
Mm.
How is there some way...
Any tattoos yourself?
No. Sorry, there was a reason for that. It wasn't just a random... Thomas Bjorn got a tattoo on his butt of the winning score in 2018 in the Ryder Cup. 17.5, 10.5, that extra half as they scratch it out on your arse and you're sitting on the table for an extra 40 minutes. Probably zero crack. But Padraig Harrington has agreed to get a tattoo if they win.
On his arse.
I don't know. It doesn't confirm it'll be on his arse. Philip Breed says it isn't.
Is that extra, like when your man's in the tattoo? He's like, if it is a bloke, I'm sure he's like not mad to do it on your ass.
Maybe he is. Who knows? 23 minutes past 8 this morning, front cover of the Examiner. Share us pictures of your tattoos if you want. We'll retweet them so long as they're SFW. The Easy Singles. Did you get this?
Yeah, there's a lot of cheese there, isn't there?
Harrington launches Cheesehead Charm offensive to woo Wisconsin fans. So the Green Bay Packers.
The cheese state.
Yeah. The Green Bay Packers were named, I think, because the local
cheese packers or
factory
something.
Was a cheese factory, and that's where the I'm sure in Wisconsin maybe it was like the cheese basket, whatever.
Are you a cheese manger?
Oh yes.
Yes.
Oh yes.
How could one not be? Yeah, well, it was once.
Give me a quick power ranking of your favorite cheeses there, Johnny.
It's probably cheddar, to be honest. Obviously Parmesan. Love a bit of burrata, Comté, Gruyere. What else have we got? Yeah, I just love, like.
Do you like the soft cheeses? Epoisse stinks.
Yeah, blue cheese can be a little bit of a stretch, Roquefort or whatever they call it from France. I was once attracted to a girl who told me like she hated cheese, and I wasn't really attracted to her anymore. I just couldn't get over that. I was like, how can you not like cheese? Like, cheese. I mean, it's just cheese is cheese. It's great. You know, yeah, probably eat too much of it.
Broke up with her.
Well, no, I don't think it ever got off the ground, actually.
It was fated.
I don't know if the cheese were the issue. Maybe the fact that she didn't fancy me was a problem. But I blamed it on the cheese. There's always a cheese excuse in them.
Backpage, the cheese stands alone. Backpage of the Irish Sun is the big cheese, Hero Poulter. I just love beating Yanks. It's great. G-R-A-T-E. You get it. Aaron Better. Connolly ends goal drought. Aaron Better.
I don't get that, actually.
Say it in an English accent for me.
Aaron Better. Don't get it.
You have to read the headlines from the
English context of the Aaron Better.
I don't. Oh, Aaron Sweater.
Ah.
Oh my God.
That's a little bit of a stretch. But to be fair to these guys, like, who are working in the Sun, and I think some of the tabloid headlines are absolutely brilliant.
Oh, they are, but that's this terrible.
It's bad, but it's also like, you might have like 30 seconds to come up with something we're going to print here.
Yeah, but that's still crap.
It's not good. It's not good. It took us, like, if it takes you half a minute to get it.
Well, that's a game we play sometimes with Owen, where like the cultural reference will be from like the late 90s and it's straight over his head.
It makes us feel old.
The Daily Mirror back page headline is Cheesy Riders.
I like that.
That's better, you know?
I like that, yeah.
Cheesy Riders, because they're all wearing the cheese heads. It's obviously the symbol of. Maybe it's the whole state of Wisconsin.
It is a cheese.
The Packers.
Yeah.
You'd see it obviously in the NFL games. It's simply too much. UEFA slam plans for biennial World Cup as dangerous to stars. Who would have thought that Arsene Wenger was going to ruin football?
Mm.
I mean, that was his destiny, is to ruin football.
Mm.
Or else it's to save football. Is there a possibility that actually we like international football, we like tournaments, that if it's on in the summertime every second year, we're going to go, you know, I actually don't disagree with this when it's on.
You mentioned NFL teams. Did you see the Ravens sort of tribute to Omar from The Wire?
No, I missed it.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
What did they do?
The fans just went into a frenzy, and all the cheerleaders kind of just gave like 20 seconds of like a kind of an Omar tribute, and the place went wild. Very sad, actually, the actor passing away. But yeah, Baltimore is obviously an interesting place, and it has, I think, like the highest rate of heroin abusers in almost the world. It's a really, really deprived place. And Omar, I think Omar resonated with people. It's a strange one in that, like, you can get very close to this guy who essentially played like a bad guy, and you kind of love him.
So he had a code.
He had a code, and he was Omar. He had his problems, but he had a nice side. And so the Ravens obviously felt his loss very deeply in Baltimore. That's the NFL. They can go into frenzy on these things.
The Daily Star back page headline is also Cheesy Riders. Ooh, I just realised that. Oh, look, snap, the Superman meme. Cheesy Riders. It's a shared tab of the morning to you. That's never happened before, where we've actually liked the headline that everybody had at the same time. Okay,
it's a bit of a countdown moment where it's like, well, I had the same seven.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, except no one ever believes that countdown. Stack head of pack in kingdom. Stephen Stack has emerged as the head of a high profile management team lining up to take charge of Kerry. So there's three groups, right? There's the incumbent Peter Keane, there's the Jack O'Connor group, and
yep.
Yesterday it was leaked that Donaghy might be part of that. We haven't had that confirmed. That was in the Examiner. And Jerry O'Sullivan from Radio Kerry yesterday tweeted that Mickey Ned O'Sullivan would be Stephen Stack's assistant manager. But Donny Buckley, who seems to be the kingmaker in all this, has been associated with this one. And we thought that Seamus Moynihan was going to be a candidate on his own, but that's not the case. He is going to be a defensive coach, with Daryl Kaneja, the forwards coach. Aidan O'Mahony and Joe O'Connor will take charge of strength and conditioning. So again, a cultural reference straight over the head of Owen Sheehan. Travelling Wilburys supergroup, you know who they are.
I can recall the Travelling Wilburys, but there's a lot of cultural stuff that I've just missed in my years for some reason.
It's a supergroup. They put together a supergroup.
It's a hell of a team. It's like nearly a football team in itself. It does look like Keane is in shtuck anyway, doesn't it? I mean, I was on with you the morning where you berated Jack O'Connor for like his quotes in the Examiner.
It's come hither eyes.
And then 2 weeks later he was gone. So it looks like Keane is in trouble anyway, doesn't it?
Well, I think that the tectonic plates and the machinations it has a bit to run. This reminds me a good bit of Jack Charlton getting the Ireland job, where he was like the fourth choice but managed to win the election. So we'll see exactly what happens. I don't think it's a done deal. I think this group believes that they aren't going to get it. I think that they're like putting it together, saying this is the type of group that you need, and we're here and we're ready to serve. But I'm not sure that they are the favourites.
Mm. It shouldn't be lost that they lost to a team who then won the All-Ireland final by 5 points. Like, you know, they lost basically an extra time.
By a point.
Yeah. And in a game when a lot went wrong for them, and goal chances.
Where their best player got injured and was literally on one leg and still kicking points.
It definitely doesn't look as bad as maybe it did at the time. And I know they were 7-1 on or whatever, but that ultimately doesn't matter.
But that was all because of COVID. And it turned out that COVID had almost no impact on.
In fact, it may have galvanised them.
But that would be an interesting supergroup to take over. And
shall I hold up one of the papers? I kind of like doing it.
Go for it. Yeah, sorry, I'm stealing your thunder here.
Because it's just it's actually in page 42 of the Independent, and it's on the COVID. Perth defends COVID record as Dundalk hit by outbreak in dressing room, and Dundalk have had a lot of COVID issues, so he's actually been forced to say, and there's still like. You're always like, well, how did you get COVID? And, you know, so on and so forth. So Vinnie Perth went into that. I actually haven't read the piece, but, and obviously, abuse of RTE staff at LOI grounds crosses the line. So that's well worth a read in the Irish Independent. And the Kinnear family called for action to address issue of dementia. I don't know. It's just like the more people you see with this is so depressing. Like, yeah. Joe Kinnear, like, again, he was this charismatic character when I was brought up following football as the Wimbledon manager, and Wimbledon were such an outlier in terms of all the things that they did, and you know, Joe Kinnear was an intriguing character and all that, and you're like, Jesus. And it's also the fact that you hear about these guys who have dementia, but it's not that they've just gotten dementia, it's like it's not talked about, and then you hear about it 5 or 6 years later,
and family have been living with it.
Yeah, and that was the case with Jack, and also with Bobby, in that, like, I didn't know Bobby had, and then it's like, what is down the road for other sports in terms of, like, heading a ball is one thing. I'm not going to mention the sport, obviously, but I mean, football is surely in the halfpenny place compared to the other one.
Rugby.
It's desperate. It's going to be awful. It really frightens me, because they didn't know what they were getting themselves in for here. And Jesus, like, heading a football is one thing. Hitting a brick wall is another.
Okay, we'll actually talk about this a bit more with John Duggan in about 10 minutes' time. OTBIM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with a new and improved razors. The Football Pod, episode 20, is out, available now wherever you want it. This week, Paddy Andrews and Andy Moran are reviewing the 2021 season, picking their team of the year. Conor Myler interview on OTBIM earlier this week sparked a really interesting conversation in the podcast about high performance in the GAA. Paddy Andrews reckons the Tyrone management have given their players the key to unlock their potential as individuals and then collectively as a team as well. So that obviously led to a natural enough question from Tommy about how did Jim Gavin get Paddy Andrews to play his best football. Have a look.
Well, I think he had the same approach to all of his players, not just me. If you look at the development of that team over that period of time, ultimately you'd probably be the most successful team and the best team in the history of GAA in terms of the winning streak they went on and the players that came through. His genius was in his leadership style, that he understood what I needed. I had a bad experience and I needed a coach to... Jim was never a man for putting his arm around the shoulder and things like that. That's, you can give belief to players in different ways, but he understood that I needed confidence. You could see there was talent because he'd managed me underage and things like that, but I needed... I had a bad couple of years and I was seriously doubting myself. Exactly. Again, reading what McCurry was saying, I was like, yeah, I know that feeling. You're thinking, maybe I'm not good enough to do this. Maybe the coaches are right and I'm never going to get a crack at this. And Andy, you had it earlier on in your career. You're moving positions and you're not playing. A coach comes in and was Jim for me and he's like, I'm playing you. You're playing all the O'Byrne Cup games. You're playing the National League. And he did it with Cormac Costello in later years. Paul Mannion. Guys coming in, you're thinking, I'm going to play you for 5 games. Don't, if you play brutal in your first game, forget about it. You're playing next week. Just allows players to relax. That's what I needed.
Mm.
Now, Bernard Brogan, who was a superstar, player of the year at the time, needed a different approach to what I did. Jim needed to get him on side, so maybe it's a bit of a kick in the backside. And then Paul Mannion's coming in. Our first National League game under Jim was against Cork, and that was the full forward line. Paul was like, I think he was 19. I'm not sure if he played in Croke Park at that point. So it was an arm around the shoulder for him, because it was like he was a kid. The genius of managers and leadership is that just understanding what's required. You need to have, there's no two ways about it. You need to be totally definitive on your vision and your goal for the team. Like, so Logan and Dewar will come in this year and say, we're winning the All-Ireland. There's no ambiguity there. There's no, I want you to buy, you know, this is, that's your leadership. There's no debate about this. But you need to be flexible in how you deal with the players and get them on side to do that. You need to be nearly a chameleon. That if I can go to you, you need a kick in the hole. If I, the next conversation I have is with a different player and you need an arm around the shoulder, that's the genius of leadership. That you don't budge on where we're going to. This is the goal. This is the strategy. This is how we're getting there. But how you deal with the individual players, that's brilliant leadership. And like I said, the days of the dictator and Myler talking about Michael Jordan and how he was just basically an asshole as a teammate, that's gone now. You won't get buy-in from 35 players to do that anymore. You need to understand your players. And you get the rewards off. And Jim was like that with me, believed in me, gave me confidence, and then away you go.
Yeah, and the thing with Michael Jordan, you had the leadership of Phil Jackson then beside him. So it was...
Completely different to Jordan.
Yeah, you had the star player style leadership, but then you had the guy that had to bring it all together. So I think that kind of emphasizes what Paddy's saying. You know?
Andy, as important as it is for the coaches to be there to facilitate this, I suppose, player development, there's a serious amount of onus on the player themselves to want to improve and to search for every inch of improvement they can get. I think it was last week you mentioned 2016, you were struggling for confidence and form and Mayo couldn't win a ball inside. You found yourself playing that year and getting into the groove and working your way into the team. And 2017 rolls around and you're footballer of the year. When you were in searching for your best self as a footballer, did you chase that? Did you open yourself up to talk to different people? To, like Conor Myler spoke about talking to a fear coach and learning how to unlock the best out of himself. He spoke about talking to somebody else about struggling with injuries and figuring that out. Like, there's a lot of responsibility on the player themselves as well.
Yeah, well, fear coach, that'd be an awful lot of, I presume, stoic philosophy and what's the worst that can happen sort of stuff. So what's the worst that can happen for a corner forward? You get bet for the ball, your man goes up the pitch, he kicks a point, you're looking over your shoulder. Can I live with this? What do I do next? I think that's the way it goes. And like, for me, I was like, it was always, I met Maurice Sheridan, I remember in 2010, to help me with my kicking, just so you get a kicking coach, you go and have sports psychology, you do all the little bits, you're taking little bits from other sports, you're trying to get, but for me, one, my body had to get right. So I would travel anywhere in the country to get my body into shape and to be healthy to play. Like, I would go anywhere at any time of night.
Really?
To get that done.
What do you mean? As in, like, what are you talking about here? Are you talking about what are you talking about here?
There's a guy there called, a guy in Port Leash, Shane Lawler, who used to work with an awful lot of pro golfers. Like, he could only see me at crazy hours of the night, and I would drive and I'd drive home. And, you know, he used to be really good to me, facilitate me, Joe, like things that people never needed to know about at the time, but you needed to do that to get your body right. Of course, psychologically though, life became very simple for me once my first child came, because then football was kind of the most important thing, but it wasn't really, because every time you came home, then everything else, it just kind of sat into place. So that helped. The body getting right helped. It really clicked into gear in the Donegal game 2015. I remember sprinting through. You should put it up for the crack. But I remember taking this outrageous shot, Jeremy O'Connor free at the back post, miles wide, but we won the game anyway. But I remember thinking, that's the first time I've sprinted in 3 years.
Really?
So little things like that. Then 16 came along, form started coming, and then it all kind of kicked into place. And the key thing for our team in 17 and for me personally was Lee Fitzpatrick came on board in 2017 for us. Psychologist, and just really got the team moving and what you need to do. Paddy, what's your job? How do you implement your job? How can you get yourself into the best position to do that job? And then it just became very simple. So everyone, I think, most people, not everyone, because you have the mavericks that do their own thing, independent thinkers, but most people go the same route. And some people like me, it might take till you're 32, 33 to find that. And other people then can find in their mid-20s. And if you can find in your mid-20s, you know, I think that is. But everyone has their own route to get there, to get the balance right. And when you get the balance right, you seem to play your best football.
Okay.
But the biggest thing on it, Tommy, as well, I'd say, just from our experience, like at this level, like the Tyrone players, the Mayo players, and to be honest, if you're playing inter-county football, we touched on it earlier in the year, it's serious business. Every player there wants to be, whether you're winning All-Ireland with Tyrone or you're getting promoted from Division 4 into Division 3, wants to be the best player they can. So you are open, you'll, do I need to go and swim in the sea when it's 2 degrees outside? I'll do it because it's going to help me recover. Do we need to go to the gym at 6 o'clock in the morning before work and go again after work? I'll do it. Do me and Andy need to go? And I know we both would have kicked thousands of footballs. I'm basically your one night of the week off from training. If you want to be the best player you can be, you've got to pay the price to go and do it. And for Myler talking about that stuff, I guarantee you, if you ask him, and I'm not sure if you did, I didn't hear it back, but he would not see any of that as a sacrifice.
No.
He's not sitting there going, what a ball breaker that I have to go and do this. Because he understands, he's an open mindset. This, it might not even, but it has the potential to make me a better player. So it's worth doing it. And at the top level of this game, all the players, you're telling me you sit down with the Mayo team now and come in with the most off the wall idea. But lads, try this for the next month. We're going to do yoga 3 times a day or whatever. And it might make you a better player. It might make you less susceptible to injuries. And it might give you a 1% chance that you can win the All-Ireland next year. Every one of those players would do it. Because you need to have the humility and the mentality to understand, I can still be a better player. I'm sure David Clifford, you know, for the 4 weeks off during COVID, the break with Tyrone, he's down kicking balls when everyone in the country's going, he doesn't need to do that. But he's still trying to be better. That the best players are always looking, how do I improve a little bit more? So reading Myler stuff, I'm like, yeah, you should be doing that. If you want to win the All-Ireland, pay the price. And I guarantee you, he'd do it all again now because he's sitting there with an All-Ireland medal in his back pocket now. He'd do anything for it. That's what it's about at the highest level.
Yeah, it strikes me from listening to him that it unburdened him in a way, realising that those things were working for him, because he did speak about overtraining a little bit in certain years and breaking down a lot, his body breaking down a lot with hamstring injuries, and finding the right way to go about balancing that off the field work with
an awful lot of high performance and high level sport time. He's getting out of your own way. Just getting out of your own way. So if you can get someone and you pay someone good money to do that, it's worth every single penny, because the overthought and overthinking absolutely kills you. When you're in bad form and you can't get to the level of performance you want to, you have to get out of your own head. So however you do that, whatever helps, wherever you go, that's the key.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. Right, no arguments. Conor Myler, number 10. On to number 11.
not every part was up for as deep discussion, but pretty much that's the level of goodness that you're getting from the Football Pod with Paddy and Andy, and of course Tommy as well. You can get it wherever you get your podcasts these days. We're going to be talking... we're going to be talking with Tony McEntee about the Gaelic Football Championship and the plans for structures, which are ultimately going to be some of the most important decisions that are ever made about Gaelic football. It strikes me that Gaelic football is on the verge of breaking out.
What do you think?
One of the proposals will result in something like 120 games between sides who are equal.
Yeah.
In high summer. What would happen if every county had a match to go to every weekend for 10 or 12 weeks, where you didn't know what was going to happen? The whole country would be on fire. We'd be ablaze with Gaelic football. But instead, we might end up with Longford versus Dublin in the first round of the Leinster Football Championship.
Well, I think, in fairness, the provincial thing is gone. Like,
no, it's not. It's not. It's not. Well, there's a very good chance it stays.
Well, the present model is going to be gone.
There's not.
It's not.
There's a very, very good chance.
Well, even writing on Saturday, like Jim McGuinness said that the status quo is not going to stay. Like, does he not?
I think he wants.
He can stick with the status quo.
I think there's a good chance that because of the way that the voting is set up, we're gonna get into this in great detail over the next couple of weeks, just to try and rally the troops.
Kevin McStay, I think, has brought up this idea, which to me is quite straightforward. And you look at the women's game and the joy that was brought to the junior and the intermediate winners and so forth. We need like a senior and an intermediate championship or something very close to that.
Yeah.
Simple as.
Yes, it's really simple.
And you can like. Say for example, like how many teams realistically will ever win a football championship right now in Ireland? Like realistically, it's so small.
You might have 6 or 8 that you can make the case for, if Dublin have more down years, but like more often than not, Dublin are going to win the All Ireland for the rest of our lives.
And if we talk to when we hear from McEntee, right? So I went past the Sligo Centre of Excellence one time, the Sligo GA Centre of Excellence with the Sligo Rovers player, and he's like, "Great facility. What's the point?" And that's the problem. Sligo will never win an All Ireland. So what can they win? Like, they won't win a Connacht Championship. So what is the point of Sligo's existence when the league is effectively a precursor to a championship that doesn't exist in their radar? So, but Sligo could possibly win an intermediate championship or a junior championship or something like that. Give them something to go to Croke Park to and bring joy to the faces of Sligo fans who basically never go to Croke Park.
Well, let's put that to Tony. Let's put that to Tony McEntee in a little while. He's been reappointed as a Sligo football manager. He's going to talk to us in a few minutes. John Duggan is with us. John, good morning to you.
Johnny, how we doing?
Good. I don't know if you want to talk about that or if you...
Cheese. JD, any thoughts on cheese?
I like cheese. Not too strong, but I do like it. Especially grilled cheese, kind of melted one.
That's a lot better than I offered.
And I've given this view so many times on Saturday and other slots about the championship. The problem with the championship in football is the provinces, the provincial councils, the politics in the GAA, the amount of units in the GAA. I wish GAA was much more centrally controlled through Croke Park, but it's not. And run the provinces off in the spring as a nice competition.
It'd be amazing. We'd love it because it'd be knocking football under lights.
If Sligo win the provincial championship, and then you get a reward for getting into a structure where you have four divisions, you have the league effectively is the championship in the summer. It's all about meaning, as Johnny was saying there. My whole thing is that if you're an Leitrim footballer and you're playing seven games against Division 4 teams, you're going home and away, you're doing it in summer football, there's crowds at it, and then you get to a Friday night at Croke Park in late August, early September, Friday night for the Division 4 final with a trophy, with a big crowd there. Super Saturday, two games, Division 2 and Division 3, and then the Sunday, the All-Ireland final for the Division 1 teams, and then you have a Monday off. You have this national celebration over 3 days, 4 days of football where there's actual meaning to it and actually something tangible to play for. And then you can progress through the divisions and become a Tyrone. You're not cut off into these two competitions. That's the way I would see it if I was the mayor of the GAA, but unfortunately I'm not.
Oh, we can
a lot of good points. Sir.
Directly elected Lord Mayor campaign starts here. Kerry, are we talking about Kerry for a moment?
Yeah, we might as well if we're on the GA theme. Stephen Stack is the latest name to emerge with Jerry Sullivan, who was on the programme with you there, Jerry, last week from Radio Kerry, putting that information out into the ecosystem that Stephen Stack, who won the All Ireland in 1997, could be heading up a dream team with Donny Buckley, Seamus Moynihan, Dara O'Kaneda, and Mickey Neto Sullivan.
Yeah.
That's a lot of cooks. Peter Keane himself, we know, could be in the running again after his 3-year term, and Jack O'Connor's also circling in the atmosphere. So with Kerry, and I'm just looking at the Kerry jersey here in the studio, there's a lot of anguish in Kerry because it's expected that they win the All-Ireland.
They were so close.
They don't have these famines. 86 to 97 was the last one of a significance I can remember. It'll be 8 years by next year. So that's what's going on in Kerry.
Yeah, there was one view put forward by various people that, that's too many people. But actually, if you look at the Dublin backroom team, they were about that size. Mm-hmm. And it's just they were slightly lower profile. And obviously, Jim Gavin was the spearhead and he brought people in as time went on. But
you like, delegate.
It's not that ridiculous that you would have somebody looking after the forwards, somebody looking after the backs. It's just that they are like all-time legends of the game. Mm.
It's almost that it's a, what's it, a cabinet? It's like a war cabinet?
Yeah.
Mm. That's how I would describe it, because it is
it's
a crisis.
War in Kerry, like.
It's a crisis of Kerry not winning All-Ireland on a regular basis.
And would that be quite appealing? Do you not think that it would be...
As long as they get on, absolutely.
Yeah, well, I presume they're being asked because there's been common ground.
That's not what you can do for Kerry.
They've been teammates. They've worked together at various stages, like the main group of them, and they obviously really respect Mickey Ned and like Mickey Ned's coaching. The South African rugby team were using Mickey Ned O'Sullivan to teach them how to catch the field the ball at one point. Like, that guy knows the game, and it would be great for, you know, a brilliant end to his managerial career if he had a comeback and was successful with it. So it's very left field. It's kind of come from nowhere. The other two, I think, are still the favourites, but It has a lot to recommend it.
No margin for error in Kerry. The expectation there, it's wonderful hospitality and great football is what they want.
I mean, if you're from Kerry, I mean, you can always console yourself with the fact that you live basically in the best place in the world. You can just go to Clarny, you can
rains
go to Dingle,
lot.
You can
rains
go to the Blaskets.
Rains a lot.
It rains a lot. But
the Kerry people you speak to, they complain about the fact that it rains a lot.
It rains a lot. I think it rains double as much in Valencia as it does in Dublin, for example. But like Kerry, I mean... grand, we were knocked out of the championship, but let's go to Dingle for the night. I mean, could be
it's
worse.
It's true. I see a lot of people giving out about Killarney just being
too touristy.
I was in Killarney in the summer. I really enjoyed it. I love the fact that you could walk out 5-10 minutes and then you're at Muckers and then you're in the lakes. So I thought it was pretty cool.
It's Kerry is literally the best place in the world. It's just off the charts. So they can always console themselves with that and the fact that they've Conor Clifford.
Donegal is pretty sweet. What's next?
Well, the League Cup, Man United, as I'm sure we've spoken about on the show, a pretty makeshift team, a degree of sacrifice around that. A 1-0 defeat to West Ham, Manuel Lanzini with the goal. Here is Ole Gunnar Solskjaer.
You know, we're at the start of the season. We know that it's going to be a long, long journey all season. Champions League, FA Cup, Premier League, we've got loads of games and we just keep on doing what we're doing, trying to get results, and we've started the season okay, apart from we're out of the this cup, which is not great, and we haven't had a great result away in Europe, but we'll be focused, we're ready for Saturday.
It was good to see Aaron Connolly on the score sheet twice for Brighton against Swansea last night. 2-0 win, first goal since January, and as manager, Graham Potter congratulated the Galway native.
Yeah, he needed the goals, and it was nice for him. He played in that little role off the left, and it's where he I think he likes his finishes from there. I thought he took the goals well, contributed to what we tried to do as a team, worked well defensively as well. So, you know, really happy for him.
Chelsea knocked out Aston Villa on penalties. Spurs knocked out Wolves on penalties. Arsenal beat Wimbledon. They will now play Leeds in the last 16. Liverpool will be away to Preston. Sad news about Joe Kinnear, the former Republic of Ireland international, suffering from dementia. His family have said he's in late stage dementia. They're preparing to admit him to full-time care. He's 74, former Tottenham player, Wimbledon manager. He was diagnosed with the disease in 2015. And Roselle, his daughter, has told The Telegraph, we need to be educating the next generation so they don't have these heading drills. So we know so many footballers have experienced degenerative diseases. Four English World Cup winners from 1966 have died, including Jack Charlton, Ray Wilson, Martin Peters, Nobby Styles. At the moment, Bobby Charlton, Dennis Law, Terry McDermott and Gordon McQueen all have dementia. A coroner ruled that Jeff Hassell's death was industrial disease as a consequence of heading leather footballs. So there's no scientific evidence to link heading the football, especially back then, with dementia, but it does seem more than a coincidence.
Mm. Chris Sutton's dad as well, of course. Chris Sutton's been very strong about this in the past. Just like Joe Kinnear, and there was a period of time where there was massive excitement, like
the Wimbledon to Dublin.
Yeah, and just with the quality of performances that he was getting from that Wimbledon team. They finished sixth,
I think. That's right, yeah, sixth, yeah.
I remember the Philips Sports Manager of the Year Awards was this kind of legendary thing in the 1990s where
jolly up.
Free bar all day, right? And Joe Kinnear was there. I don't know if he was getting the overall gig or if he was showing up because he'd been one of the managers of the month. And I just started getting gigs at FM 104 as like a reporter who would go and stick the microphone. I remember going there and seeing this bacchanalian an orgy of every hack in town absolutely shit-faced at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And Joe Kinnear was very good with his time. But I remember being a little bit starstruck by the fact that like, this guy, he's like in this room of Ireland's best sports people and managers.
Long link with the Ireland job.
He was kind of the standout presence, and also very avuncular, brilliant charisma, like a proper, you know, this guy's he's in control here, and to see where he ends up is absolutely horrific.
It's shocking
for his family, and
it's shocking. And like, you know, the Jack Charlton documentary, I forget the name of it now. I don't know if you guys remember, but the, you know,
Jack Charlton
being
Jack Charlton,
and obviously Andy Town
finding Jack Charlton.
Jack Charlton. I mean, an unbelievably powerful piece of TV. A lot of people will go back to his recognition of Paul McGrath, and I think half of the country watching that practically started to well up in tears at that moment where he recognised Paul McGrath on the screen. But it's, as his wife so eloquently described it, it's the frustration within the person himself that he knows he should remember this, but he just can't. And it was really, really crippling watching it. And as much as we shouldn't remember Jack Charlton from the years that he had dementia, we should remember the great days that he had, and it was towards the latter end of his life. It's it's not only the person as well, it's the family. They've lost someone. And it's... I guess it'll probably end up with football's, you know, not being headed anymore in the game, but at least football is kind of confronting it, I think.
Yeah, kind slowly. Of. Like, as you know, does football get ruined if we go to a size 4 football instead of a size... It actually doesn't. It becomes more skillful and better and less damaging in the long run. I don't know. Like, did they just ban it completely?
I think people would say now, the ball is lighter, it doesn't make a difference because the speed of the ball is an issue as well. And it's the treatment of concussion which is key around this. And
we just see that football is not serious about that, even though they pretend to be. They are not serious about concussions. They're like, player gets knocked out, is back playing in the same game, like, and then, you know, we've seen it in the World Cup. We've seen players be concussed and not remember and going back out, and we've seen players be concussed and playing 3 days later. Like, whatever about rugby's issues, they took a long time to wake up to them, and at least they have protocols in place. Whether or not those protocols in 20 years time we'll be looking back going, Jesus, that didn't make any sense, you know. With football, there doesn't really, there's lip service being paid. It's football's like a decade and a half behind where rugby is, and I don't think rugby has reached an end point on it either. So it's a huge issue.
You just wonder what the bill is in 20, 30 years' time that we can't see at the moment.
It's like climate change. It's like, what is coming down the tracks here? You know, but anyone who's kind of misgivings about, you know, the concussion protocols, whatever, just read about Joe Kinnear and, you know, read about the distress that this would bring to a family and how utterly sad it is and how you basically lose a person. He's not who he was, and... You know, we have to confront that.
And he would have been diagnosed with in his late 60s as well.
That's the interesting thing, JD. You hear about this, like in this instance, you often hear about it years later. It's kind of similar with John Hume. I wasn't aware, and it's kind of almost not spoken about because I think there's so much distress in the family that this great person is effectively gone that they don't really want to talk about it. I'm not saying they're ashamed, but they want to keep it to themselves.
Yes, and he was, as you say, Ger, a very ebullient character on that RT panel in 1994, the World Cup. And at a time, I didn't think he'd be the next Ireland manager. And when he won that FA Cup at Spurs in 1967, he was the youngest player on the pitch.
I'd say they had some good nights out.
Absolutely.
And hopefully that's how people remember him.
Just to finish on the Ryder Cup, the opening ceremony later today in Wisconsin, Europe against the United States will learn the pairings. And Porter Carrington is so committed and so determined to win this that he has made a promise if he does.
Yes, I will be getting a tattoo. If my team produce a winning week, I will be getting a tattoo to mark the occasion, and very comfortable that they only asked that much of me because I would have given more.
The last person in the world I would have expected to get a tattoo would be Patrick Harrington.
Thomas Bjorn kind of shamed him into it.
Yeah.
JD, a tattoo man?
Yeah. Do you have any?
Me?
Yeah.
No, not in a million years. Not in a million years. I wouldn't. Mm. I wouldn't scar my body in that way, because I can just imagine you put "I love Mum" on your arm, and then when you're 80, it'd look absolutely ridiculous.
All right. On that
wouldn't
note,
be
JD,
cool either, would it?
Good stuff. Thanks very much for that. It's 8:58 this morning. It's time for us to turn our attention to potentially the biggest 3 or 4 weeks in Gaelic football. Like, what is coming down the tracks is a decision on how we manage and run the sport. Essentially, and we know it's not forever, but all of these decisions that have been made have had far-reaching consequences. The qualifiers came in and then nothing really essentially changed for 20 years. So we're looking at the next 20 years of Gaelic football. To give us a perspective on this, I'm delighted to say Tony McEntee, the Sligo manager, is with us. Tony, good morning to you. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you. I'm very good. Thank you.
So we've been chatting about this in the office over the last few days, and it's hard to overstate how important the debate is about the structures, because if we get this wrong, it could be a long time before we're allowed to have the conversation properly again. But if we get it right, it feels to me like Gaelic football is primed to be a massive breakout sport where literally every county believes they have an opportunity of winning meaningful games 4 or 5 times a year. And all of a sudden, every kid growing up who plays Gaelic football is given the opportunity to dream.
Yeah, it does seem like that, doesn't it? But I suppose there is a challenge initially, and that challenge is the amount of conversations that's currently happening in respect to this structure. And with this meeting coming up now in 3 or 4 weeks, there is a concern, or well, we'll have this meeting this November, is it? Whenever there is a concern here that there hasn't been enough discussion and debate about it, and the outcome here might actually be to remain in the status quo because we haven't had the chance to discuss things. Because that unknown piece, the uncertainty piece, the piece around the trying to pacify the concerns of the provincial councils, as an example, that's something that has to be discussed, and they have to be brought along this journey with you and I and everybody else for that matter, or else what's going to happen is when it comes to the central meeting, that there'll be no change because they'll be afraid of change and they'll not know what change means. And as a result, we will be in that stalemate whereby you saw at the start of this year, as an example, like the first 4 or 5 games was all 20-point defeats, and that's not something that we need going forward in our game.
It's essentially 4 weeks. That's when Congress is going to be. And there's certainly, from the GAA journalists who would know these things and who would kind of be talking to the people who are going to vote, there is concern that neither of the proposals will pass. And so therefore, we'll automatically fall back to either the Super 8s or even what predates the Super 8s, which was just the straight qualifiers. I think there's a concern about the Super 8s not fitting in the new split season calendar. So we could just end up with essentially straight knockout with qualifiers again. What difference would that make to a county like Sligo, for example, Tony?
We saw the impact this year, didn't we? So we trained this year. Yes, a disruptive year when the thing started, but we trained this year for a game against Mayo, and we got beat by 23 points against Mayo, and our season's over in a flash. And that season was a season where we had four games in advance of that. So for players in Sligo, for the players in Down, for the players in Clare, for all those teams that got hammered in that first weekend, what does it all mean? Like, what does it all mean when you're asking them to come back now in October, November, December, and start a year of football again, to turn around again in next June? We were out in June. Before June was over, Sligo Championship was over this year. And the biggest problem with this, apart from the obvious issue in relation to player morale and things like that, is that the good teams continue on, and the good teams get the chance to get better, and the good teams get more training in, and the good teams get more like-minded or competitive competition as the year goes on. So the good teams just get better and better and better, and the teams that's trying to catch up just simply don't have the chance. So should this structure remain for the next number of years? Because we can't... because the councils in particular can't get over their financial concerns, this will have huge impact for players in Sligo and elsewhere. And if I look at it practically for me as a Sligo manager, right now I'm going to the games in Sligo, and the whole management team is. We're trying to get all the games in. We've been to most of the league matches, we've been at most of the championship matches, and soon, very soon now, we'll be asking players to come in and join the Sligo panel, and they're going to ask that question: for what? For what, Tony? We're going to get 4 games next year, and we're going to put in 6 months hard work. And it's a difficult argument, a difficult discussion to have with a player that you're asking to come in, put so much in, and get so little out of it.
What would you like to see?
I'd love to see the just me personally, and we did a I'm not sure if a poll is the right word for it, but we had a discussion with the players. And it wasn't unanimous by any means, but the majority of them thought that the option to go for the provincial championships as an early season option, and then followed into a group stage or learning series, was the preferred option, for many reasons, but principally because the provinces still happen. It maybe doesn't have the same status as it did before, but particularly because we got a number of games against competitive teams, and we had a chance to win our province, to compete in the All-Ireland series, and to progress properly as a team over a period of time. So certainly the option I would be looking for, I don't know if it's A or B nowadays, it's changed a couple of times, but that option where you have the provincial series first, followed then by a league stroke championship format.
Yeah, and the league it seems to make a lot of sense. There's some debate about, oh, if you finish fifth in Division 1, you won't get into the All-Ireland Series, and how is that better than finishing top of Division 4? It's like, well, you got beaten in loads of games in the league. That's, you know, you just need to improve next season. That's how competition works. Not everybody gets to progress.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's actually the sixth team in Division 1, but still, the same thing applies, you're right. It creates that competition. Like, there's nobody in Division 1 entitled just to get straight into an All-Ireland Series. So, you're right. Perform well in the league, there's an incentive there for everybody. And that incentive isn't just Division 1, it runs right through to Division 4, you know. And should Division 3 and Division 4 teams still struggle, there is that Tailteann Cup. And that remains there for them, you know.
And just there's an interesting point here as well, I think, in that like the ladies football final recently got a massive TV audience, yet if you ask like the floating kind of Gaelic Games fan, he or she mightn't be able to name one player from the Sligo football team, yet Sligo are very good footballers, they're just not getting to be showcased at all.
Absolutely, to be fair, that's Sligo, but it's not just Sligo. There's so many good footballers out there who get so little exposure, because there's nobody interested in games that happens. Like, we made TV this year with I think it was Sky actually covered the Mayo game, but it was simply because Mayo was in it. And if it hadn't been anybody else, there's no way that game would have been on TV. And we have some excellent footballers there who are more than competitive in most teams that they might be on. We need more, obviously, and I'm not going to pretend that we're at like Mayo at this stage, but we're certainly a team that puts a lot of hard work in. Players put a lot of hard work in, and I think, and this isn't about exposure, right, Niles. I think it's if we're going to ask these players to keep putting that effort in, if we're going to ask the smaller counties to keep working hard, we need something for them to achieve. We need something that they can see and grasp. We need a goal that's somewhat achievable, not a goal that's so lofty and ambitious that we get there once in a lifetime. This dream, guys, just simply doesn't happen. This dream is, you know, no more. It used to be like when Armagh won the first 11 or Clare won the first 11. Like, those are dreams that happen, you know, but not anymore. The good teams are just so organised. They're so fit, they've such a high pick of players, they're so well conditioned, they've so many resources available to them, you know, that the smaller teams are just simply not going to make that breakthrough. It just won't happen anymore. Like, it's just not anymore possible. So in order for us to progress as Sligo and the rest of these teams that we're talking about, we need to do it bit by bit over a number of years. And if we're going to do that, then we need to be competitive over a number of years, or at least we need to have the chance of being competitive over a number of years, so that these players can keep putting that effort in, you know. And I think in the case of the GAA themselves, and I know they're working on this, they're working on a financial model that will offset the provincial finances that the provincial counties get for the different championships. The GAA is looking at a financial model, I understand, for that will send money back to the provinces that more than offset the loss that they will have by losing the priority of the provincial championships.
I actually think that the notion that the provincial championships will suddenly become completely irrelevant isn't true, because what's going to happen is the All-Ireland final will be in late June, early July, maybe it'll sneak into August, and there'll be no inter-county football for 6 months. So when the provincial championship comes back the following spring, everybody who is an inter-county fan will want to go and see the inter-county games, and it'll be a short, sharp shock, a blitz, essentially, over 3 or 4 weeks. And we'll be like, oh, this is great. It's brilliant. These players are back. And now let's talk about what's going to happen in the Sam Maguire race. Like, I think we have a tendency to go to the worst case scenario in all of this, as opposed to seeing the possibility. And for me, the bit where you're talking about the players, for what, Tony? When you, if the new championship comes in, when you're saying to players, well, there's going to be 7 or 8 games in the league, and if we win 7 of those games, we're going to be in an All-Ireland either quarter-final or whatever that round is going to be called. Like, it'll be the first tangible sign of progress that we've been able to stand over since we won a Connacht title 15 years ago. But yeah, we have a good chance, because those teams are the same quality as us. They're almost exactly the same quality as us, so why not us?
Yeah, and the beauty of that particular model, where the provincial championship comes first, you still have the opportunity of playing against Mayo and Galway in this case. You know, you still can say we played against Mayo and Galway. It's not that you'll ever play any of them teams now with the new series playing in Division 3 and Division 4. You play a Provincial Championship, you get the opportunity, you compete against them, you win or lose, it really makes no difference, and you get into the Ireland series. You know, so I don't see a loss. That there has been, and I've spoken to Sligo people actually, and Sligo people say that, you know, we always need to have that ambition of playing Mayo and Galway and the chance to beat them. You know, that's your mark. You know, that's your mark. And listen, fine, that is your mark. But it's just too far away. It's just simply not achievable.
Well, just like when Leitrim's Connacht Championship win, this is at a time when we'll say Leitrim took on a Mayo team that was an absolute rabble. But like nowadays, the professionalism and all the work that goes in and the resources that goes into the bigger counties, it's pretty much completely impossible for the likes of Sligo and Leitrim to now compete with Galway and Mayo. Simple as.
Simple as, yeah. And Sligo, and we got to face the facts here. Like in Sligo, for example, like we're now 10 years effectively in Division 4. You know, we bounce up to Division 3 and back down. It was effectively 10 years in Division 4. A Connacht final, as you said, back that same length of time, 10 years or more ago at this stage. And we need to be, and all the smaller counties, we need to be realistic. We need to understand where we are at the minute. We need to accept where we are at the minute. We need to be comfortable that we are in whatever position we're in at the minute. Because until we accept that, then we're not in a place that we can grow or we can develop or we can mature into the team that we might be in the future. If we keep looking at the likes of Mayo and Galway and think that we're them, and think that we can compete against them realistically on the big occasion, well, then we're only fooling ourselves. In a lot of ways, we're only fooling ourselves. And that's just not us. It's Division 2, 3 and 4 counties at the minute. So in a lot of ways, we need to accept that. But the smaller counties, Sligo and everybody else, accepting that alone is not enough. Because we're not totally in control of our destiny here. And that's why this is important, that we look at about change in structure.
Isn't that why it's important
what happens.
And Tony, isn't there a kind of a sense of like trying to win the hearts and minds here? Like just Sligo as an example, like Markovic Park is a really iconic ground, but like when did a Sligo fan last go there and really feel passion in his heart because, you know, I saw a Sligo team do so well? Whereas you can go to the showgrounds and you can see Johnny Kenny score for Sligo Rovers in a professional league. And if you're a young player who might be toggling between Sligo Rovers and Sligo football, and I'm not sure if there's much of a crossover, it's like, well, I could have a professional career and possibly win a league with Sligo Rovers, or I could go to play football for Sligo and be a baby elephant mauled by lions in Castlebar.
Yes. Listen, the biggest problem we have in Sligo is the soccer. The soccer does well. I think it's, you know, in my view on it, it's a slightly fool's goal looking at the soccer piece, because I'm not sure there's that many homegrown Sligo players playing with Sligo Town. But the second issue we have then would be potentially rugby. We have a few players who actually would be very good at the rugby as well, and Connacht rugby would be reasonably strong. And then, for good or bad, the actual issue that impacts us most in the football end is the hurling. We have quite a crossover of players who are very good for us on the football side, that also are very good for Sligo at their level in the hurling side. And this presents an issue for us as a small county, because we have 23 clubs in Sligo at the minute. We have 50,000 people in total. And in a short season, it is impossible to play two sports in a short season and get all the games in and to get some level of training or coaching or conditioning or otherwise for those types of players. So that's a big issue. And I know it's not a big issue elsewhere, because dual sports people just simply are a rarity at this stage. You know? And if we could accommodate it, we have four or five possibly in Sligo who play hurling, who we would like on the football panel.
Okay, that like, and
that's news to a lot of people, isn't it?
Well, and look, you can see it in other counties as well. Wexford definitely have issues where there's a crossover, and I actually don't know what the solution to that is. I definitely know what the I think, like, it's interesting to hear that your players, it's not unanimous, but certainly it sounds like the bulk of them were in favour of the league campaign. Are you guys, do you feel like this next month is important for you to have your voice heard, for the players to have their voice heard, to tell the administrators what's on the line here is like hundreds and hundreds of young inter-county players from counties in divisions 2, 3 and 4 just walking away from the game, because what's the point?
Yes, now listen, I believe from conversations with the county board that the county board are very much supportive of this. The county board in Sligo at least are very progressive. They want improvement in Sligo, they want improvement in Connacht actually. So they're very progressive towards change, and they understand that change in this case means disrupting the provincial councils. And I do also believe that the other counties and county management and county teams in Connacht, in this case if I stick with Connacht, are also in favour of change, or potential change at least in one of those two options that might be available. The difficulty though arises that the provincials are the ones that don't want change, or potentially don't want change. Now when it comes to Congress, each county has their own mandate, I guess, and their own vote. So it's not the provincials that vote, clearly, as we know. But will they be under pressure from the provincials will they be mandated from the provincials to vote the way the provincials want, or will they accept their own county vote from their own committee? So I suppose therein lays the issue, is that pull and tug between paymaster and pay, like, you know, as what outcome will come there. But what I would say is that we need the task force to come up with these rules, to come forward with further explanation on the financial proposals. We need enough information so that the walls that have been built up with provincial councils can be knocked down, and that they can be given more reassurance and understanding around the financial pieces. Because once that's sorted out, I do believe that everybody will be consistent in moving forward with progression here in relation to GAA. And I hope that that is the case. Because earlier in the year, or sorry, the end of last year, we had a situation whereby the GAA task force, or one of the task force, made a decision to move from odds to evens in year grades, resulting in the under 17 minor grade. And I'm not sure, well, I'm certain at least that minor grade system at 17 years of age is not working. And I'm just conscious here that we will end up with a second policy decision making coming from task force that either is adopted or not, and will be the wrong decision. And I think already we have a huge problem with under 17s coming through the seniors. And if we now have a situation where we have the county situation is not sorted out, we've two major headaches in the GAA that we are simply not dealing with. And I think that's going to be a problem for us moving forward, right across the board.
Tony, great to have you with us this morning. Congratulations on the re-ratification, and thanks a million for sharing those views, because it's important that we get them here. Cheers.
Thanks, guys.
Tony McEntee giving us his thoughts there, and as I said, ratified for another year in Sligo. We've got to take a quick break. It's 17 minutes past 9. We're back with Louise Quinn next.
OTB AM.
18 minutes past 9 this morning here on OTB AM. Delighted to say Louise Quinn is with us to reflect on a big win for the Ireland football team against Australia, 3-2 win in Tala earlier this week. Louise, good morning to you. How are you?
Good morning, how's things?
Yeah, good. What was the immediate feeling after getting the victory against a team as ranked as highly as Australia are? What was that like?
Yeah, I think obviously just overjoyed to kind of get the win and kind of, you know, hold on for the majority of that second half. I thought we actually just performed brilliantly, and how we kind of still were in control of the game. And that feeling, yeah, I really didn't feel like that they were going to score. And obviously then when the whistle went, it was, you know, I think it was that sort of, like, you know, bit of scream of joy kind of for that kind of, you know, holding them off in the second half, really.
The build-up to the game, I guess, people have been talking about the recent run of defeats. And I know some of those games are important, some of those games are less important because they're friendlies. But the way that a run gets talked about is it all just kind of congeals. It's like, oh, this is a losing team on a losing run at the moment. So, although it was a friendly against Australia, there was extra importance to it.
Yeah, of course. We're always looking to win the games and not kind of keep, you know, having the results that we don't want. But I just really didn't think into it too much. I know I think there was a lot of talk about it, but I genuinely didn't hear too much, or it wasn't the thing that was on the, you know, the top of my mind. It was, right, let's try get a result against this, you know, against this quality side, you know, who have just competed so well at the Olympics. And, you know, for me, and I think the rest of the squad, obviously how we approached the game, that was generally it. It was just, you know, wanting to really get a result out of Australia when we knew as well kind of that we, you know, that we could. An absolutely excellent side, especially, you know, up top, their speed of play is unbelievable. So yeah, to try kind of stop that and you know, kind of be able to take the win from that is incredible. And I think even, you know, yeah, their style of play could even be, you know, something similar to what we want to kind of do one day, you know, just that really kind of fast transition and, you know, how they deal with this and finish their chances.
It's Ireland's first win, Louise, over a higher ranked nation in 30 years. But like, is there a different mentality in the squad? Because it's kind of during further, there are noises about Vera's in the sense of the run of defeats. But, you know, I often feel that there's what people say from the outside and what people say from within the squad. And do you guys actually feel that this is all just, we're making progress, we've lost games against good teams, and we are actually on a kind of a progressive step under her?
Yeah, exactly. I think from what you know, the squad were just in great form, you know, this last 10 days, and that, you know, that was really shown. It was something where, yeah, we had a difficult summer in Iceland, and, you know, those couple of games. So coming into camp in Ireland, you know, the staff obviously working extremely hard to, you know, to thankfully be able to change the game against Georgia. You know, because of COVID restrictions, that was, it just shows kind of everywhere that, you know, that every squad member in here, from staff to player, kind of fights for each other. So just started the week off, you know, really well, and then obviously just concentrating on Australia was our target. And yeah, just everything just again just came together, you know, really, really nicely. And I think that kind of, yeah, it really kind of set the mood for the camp.
We know that confidence in sport it's fragile, but when it's there, it kind of infuses into a team really quickly, and they start taking risks and they start trying things, and partnerships build. Is this one result enough to get that into the team? Because obviously the campaign starts with an absolute bang against the best two teams next month. You're a month away from playing the two best teams in the group, and if those results go the way the one against Australia did, then geez, the world's your oyster. You can do anything at this stage.
Yeah, hopefully, of course, we're going to take confidence from it. We enjoyed the victory, and, you know, we have to do that. But then it is about analysing it, seeing what we can actually, again, do better on it. And then, yeah, I suppose then kind of technically comparing it a little bit to how the Swedes play. But as you said, it's that confidence, and that's something that maybe at times that we lacked. But obviously now playing some of these bigger nations now for the last while, it kind of just goes to show that we can get results off them. I know, obviously, again, as you said, the previous weren't, but they were close games, and sometimes even though we underperformed, they were still relatively close, some of them. You know, we definitely still needed those performances. So that's kind of it, that consistency of performance, and that consistency of, yeah, you know, believing in ourselves and having that confidence. You know, and so this was one of these, you know, big moments, hopefully, that we have to build off, that we kind of have, you know, we have no choice which way we want to take it forward here. We kind of have to be able to build off that, because we know we're capable of doing it, you know, or kind of sit back and just enjoy that victory for what it was. But no, it's about trying to push forward and keep going with it.
Do you feel there's a real rapport building with the fans as well? I think there's talk that it might be actually sold out in Tala when you play Sweden and that. And obviously, like with all sports, you even talk as like some of the senior men's players that basically hadn't played in front of a crowd until maybe the Portugal game. Like, and a lot of you guys missed out on that as well. Like, but that rapport is probably starting to build now.
Yeah, it was incredible walking back out to the noise again. It really, like, and that was it. You know, I've played in front of now, yeah, a couple of crowds, but that was just something. It was so recognisable as well. It's kind of weird, you know, exactly when it is. You know, if you're to play crowd noise, I'd know exactly what kind of the Irish crowd noise would be. So it really was something, yeah, something special. And, you know, the fact that we were able to thank them again, and and you know, go over and have a, you know, have a few chats, was just really, really special. As much for the fan, it was as special for us as it was.
You guys
fans.
Are great for that. Like, you actually, it's not so much like, oh, you know, oh, the manager comes up and you clap them off the pitch. Oh, you're great. You actually go over and kind of converse with them after the game, take photos, and like, what does that do for a kid who like has her icons there in front of her?
Yeah, we just love it. Like, we really like. And we've noticed that even more and more, especially in the last campaign when we had the crowd there. Just this extra electricity kind of came over us. You know, we just, something just started to happen and click more. And, you know, and it's just, it's so, so encouraging. And then, yeah, as you see, there's, you know, kids' eyes kind of lighting up. And, you know, what's not to love about that, to be honest? You know, we are footballers, but we're also trying to, you know, be role models and inspire the next generation of people coming through. And, you know, there was at times, yeah, even still when I was going to games when I was a kid, if any player kind of came near you, said hello, it was something, you know, something really special that can stick with you. So, you know, if we can kind of plant some of those memories in and inspire them, that's something that this squad, yeah, you know, we love to do.
And then they're going to get to see you guys play on Saturday morning on Sky Sports, the Birmingham Everton game, and a huge Irish contingent involved on both sides in that one. So, like, it rolls on. This is kind of, it's not like just once a year there's a big game and the stadium is full. It's kind of non-stop coverage for people who are into it now.
Yeah, it's non-stop. There's, you know, games constantly every weekend. It's so accessible. Yeah, and for us, that's it. We just got to, you know, keep rolling, keep going. And yeah, to kind of have then that Sky Sports deal is just a massive step forward for women's football and just making it that accessible and, you know, and showing off what it's all about.
And Lucy Quinn and yourself are striking up quite the partnership.
Still not related.
No, definitely not, no. But yeah, she's just been... You know, she just did. Like, her debut is just something to be reckoned with. To be honest, it was class, and you know, so I live with her as well. So we've been kind of talking about these things. Obviously, the process that she had to kind of go through, and yeah, for it to finally happen, and then you know, cap it off with the goal and a really dodgy celebration was. Yeah, was something else.
Yeah, the stuff dreams are made of. But listen, best of luck this weekend, and thanks a million for joining us this morning. Congratulations. I didn't even ask you about the winner. At what point does the ball kind of leave your head and you're like, yeah, that's gone, back in the net, thanks very much?
I don't know. It just kind of it was just coming for me, and just no one else was kind of getting their head in it, so I was like, right, so like, you know, poop down to go get us. And yeah, I don't know, you just have that kind of flash second where you just kind of see it just about going in, and then yeah, just that runaway. It's only literally a millisecond that you kind of see that's right, this is, yeah, there we go, that's actually gone in there, that's just about hit the nest. So yeah, I don't know, but it was, yeah, it was great, and obviously just to kind of contribute in that way was amazing.
And no dodgy celebration?
No, it was all right, actually. Just a nice kind of wheel away or run away into, run towards Katie, you know?
7 out of 10.
Harsh.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully you'll get plenty more practice. Louise, good stuff. Thanks a million for joining us. Cheers.
Thank you.
It's Louise Quinn giving us some thoughts there on a big win for Ireland and ahead of a big game for Birmingham against Everton at the weekend.
It's just great to have crowds back as well. Like,
I think the crowds,
it makes it, like, it's literally been pretty much proven now that crowds are the difference in home and away, in home advantage and not home advantage. And like, whatever chance Ireland have against Sweden with no one there, a full Tala, it makes a massive difference.
Well, I was going to say as well, like, they had just started to sell out Tala for the games, and they really missed them. They clearly missed them, and they clearly missed that kind of,
it's soon they'll be in the Aviva Stadium, if not selling out, like selling huge seats, because that's the only way this thing is going, like, in general, I think.
OTBAM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Tomorrow morning we're going to chat with Alan Quinlan, Andy Lee, much more as well. Owen's going to be back and is going to join Adrian in studio.
OTB AM with Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.